Good evening. This is Carol Murphy. I'm your host for Heartstock Radio. This evening, our guest is Dr. Andrew Chacko. He's using design thinking to innovate for the future of healthcare. In just a minute, Andrew will be back and tell you all about what he's up to. Remember that you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. You can also email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. In just a moment, Dr. Andrew will be back to tell you about his endeavors in healthcare. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. This is Heartstock Radio. I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Our guest this evening is Dr. Andrew Chacko. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, Carol. Great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for joining us. And can you just give our listeners a little introduction of who you are and what you're doing in the field of healthcare?
So that's kind of a interesting and wonderful story that I'd love to lead you on the path, because it was a path of discovery for me. I spent the first part of my professional life really focused on leadership and teamwork. I was an officer in the Navy. I went to the Naval Academy, and that just had already been looking at the military as a way to understand those skills. And so that was for 12 years. And as I was getting to that point, I decided, wow, I really feel like Peter Pan. I need to grow up and go back to school and get not a real job, but something that felt more serious. And I happened to stumble on this program at Stanford, and it was a joint program in mechanical engineering and art, and I was sold. Those were two huge interests of mine, and marrying them just made so much sense. So there I was at the design program. That's what it was. It was a master's in product design, and studying that, and I really enjoyed it. And I ended up taking a third year to go in depth to study robotics and study entrepreneurism and work at IDEO, which is this big design firm, and teach design and even freelance as a designer. And I was working on a Swiffer, which is a great product, and people get pretty excited when I say that I was doing that. But in order to make a Swiffer, you have to test it out. That's part of the design process. And in order to test it out, you need to make lint. And there I was making lint to test out a Swiffer. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got a master's degree from Stanford and I'm making lint. I've got to put this to better use. And so I started looking around at what areas needed really great design. And I literally saw doctors carrying pagers, and I thought, that's really ridiculous. I can make something better than that. And as I started looking into the field of design and healthcare and medical device design, I started getting some feedback from some colleagues and mentors saying, this is a great field, but it's really difficult as designers to get time with clinicians. It's hard to get their time, let alone get a word in edgewise, difficult to communicate. And I thought, ooh, I grew up with a bunch of doctors. I kind of know how that is. And so I thought, well, rather simplistically thought, I'm a pretty good student. How hard is medical school? Maybe it'd be easier as a designer if I did it from the inside as a physician. So off I went, much to the shock of my mentors and dean. It didn't make sense to go to medical school. I was the first one coming out of the program that decided to do that. And I thought, well, it's 4 years. How bad could that be? I'd been in the Navy for 12. I could basically felt like I could stand on my head for 4 years. So there I was with the intention of punching out in after medical school and going straight into the innovation space, and actually had a wonderful offer from MIT from the Media Lab after graduation to come build like what the future of healthcare was going to look like. And as much as that was so tempting, it was just such a wonderful offer, I felt I didn't understand clinical medicine enough. And there were plenty of people leaving med school once they had their MDs and going straight into consulting or other kind of work. And yet we were facing these really what was beginning to see as like epic problems. And I thought it must be from a lack of clinical understanding. And so I thought, well, at least I have to get intern year done. And as I was getting that done, I felt I was starting to see my perspective was changing. And I was starting to learn more and more about it. So I thought I better finish this up. So I stayed through and finished my residency and then ended up moving back to the Bay Area so I could practice full time and really cinch down those lessons or build on that clinical understanding while I was teaching med device design at Stanford. And then that led me to, then I was invited on to a panel at Stanford to help reimagine what the future of mental health care would be. My residency, by the way, was in psychiatry. I felt like of the disciplines that I totally loved, I loved surgery. My first choice was plastics and second choice was orthopedics. And then third choice was psychiatry. Of those disciplines, the one that would be the most tolerant of me having a second professional passion was psychiatry. And it turned out to be a super smart decision for me to go into that field for a number of reasons, especially around the innovation front. So there I was on this panel to reimagine the future of mental health care, and then was invited to teach along some pretty big names at their, it's the second largest conference that they hold around mental health care. Second largest conference that they hold, and it was around mental health care. And then the response was so positive, I decided, okay, I'm going to take this show on the road, so to speak, and start seeing like where else I can start helping people understand how some of these design skills can really help shape the discussion. So that's kind of what I've been doing. And last year I ended up traveling to like 11 different conferences and events and workshops to do that teaching while I was still doing full-time clinical practice. So I take that back. I forgot we're now in 2019. So in 2017, I had traveled to like these 11 different conferences, and that made me decide in 2018, I was going to leave full-time clinical practice, which I did a few months ago, to really focus on what this innovation space looks like in healthcare. So that's the circuitous path that got me here.
That's jam-packed with a whole lot of different educational perspectives. And that's one thing that I noticed came up a lot when I was doing some research for this program. So one thing that I would really like to touch on is what you said earlier, that you felt there were some epic problems being realized in the field of healthcare. What were those epic problems? And are we at the point that they've been conquered and now we have other problems, or are they still prevalent?
Oh, no, I think that they're still there. And I'm going to put hubris aside and just be plain, like, in some ways, I think that some of them aren't even being recognized. And one of the blessings that I've had that is very much a result of like this path is I look at healthcare from very different lenses. So I look at it from a leadership and teamwork perspective. I look at it from a design and innovation perspective, and certainly as a healthcare provider, and then also as a patient and just part of someone in the system. And one of the things that also plays into that as a psychiatrist, as someone that tries to understand influence and why people do what they do, you know, all that leads into a kind of different view of what problems we're facing. So no, I think we're definitely facing them. And a few years ago, I started writing a book around like how we're going to innovate in healthcare and where we should be focusing or can be focusing. And I distilled it down to like four pillars, four paradigms of healthcare that if we can revisit those fundamental paradigms, we can radically shift how we provide healthcare. And they would be, the first is around education, how we educate clinicians and educate people in general is really arcane. And basically, if you look at our educational system in medicine, it's very much a glorified apprenticeship model. And apprenticeships are really great for if you want to learn how to make earthenware pots the way your great grandfathers made it, and or grandmothers for that matter. But as in such a rapidly evolving field like healthcare, doing things the way our great-great grandparents did it, not really the most effective way to learn or to learn how to practice medicine. So it's inherently stagnant, and it doesn't even take advantage of what we know about learning and how we learn and what's optimal. The second one is around leadership and why leadership is such a fundamental clinical tool and a part that we need to like incorporate into healthcare altogether, or a skill set that we should incorporate into healthcare. The third is around design and what design means and what it means to design the healthcare experience system, even down to the objects that we use. And the fourth thing, which falls under the design category, but it's kind of taking on such a big footprint that it does deserve its own area, is digital health and what digital health means and can mean and what the real true promise of it is. And right now we're looking as clinicians, I feel, how technology has been introduced into our lives is very much kind of, especially EMRs and electronic health records, is just been the bane of our existence, and how it can go from that to really what fundamentally transforms medicine and makes it really vital space.
Yes, I think we could probably do a program just on each one of these categories. Yeah. It's a very deep, rich subject that, yeah, I agree it needs to be taken on, and I'm so glad that you're doing that. But let's focus just for a second, because I think we need some clarity on leadership. Can you maybe give us an example of how leadership goes right or wrong in healthcare?
Yeah.
Like so, a for example. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I have a rather sad example, but I think it's indicative of what we're doing. So like I said, I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, and I was shadowing during med school in my fourth year an orthopedic surgeon who, just a fantastic surgeon, really great with his patients, great clinical outcomes, you know, a real rock star, and a really good guy. And I enjoyed hanging out and learning from him and whatnot. So we're in the OR, and the nurse brings in the wrong tool. And he went crazy. I saw the little disclaimer about what I can and can't say.
You can't repeat what he said.
I can't repeat what he said, but, you know, and I'd been professionally like hazed, both at the Naval Academy, and I had captains who would throw like hot cups of coffee across the bridge at people that didn't meet with their approval. And I was just mortified to hear what was coming out of his mouth and how this nurse was being treated. And to the point where I went outside after the surgery was over and I approached her, because, you know, I was following her, shadowing her anyway, as we went to greet the next patient. And I pulled her aside and said, "I'm so sorry that was terrible and I wish that hadn't happened. And she said, oh, honey, that was nothing. I used to be in cardiothoracic surgery. And all I could think is, what are they doing in there? I mean, like physical assault? Like, how could it get, how could it get much worse? And so then I go to the next patient and she had this big smile on her face. She said, hey, how are you doing? We're getting ready for you. The OR is getting cleaned. And it has the anesthesiologist been by to talk to you and, you know, just carrying on a normal conversation with this person or like really engaged and making the patient feel at ease. And I thought, man, if that was me, they'd just been reamed out like that. The conversation would have gone much more like this. But the OR is getting ready. has the anesthesiologist been by? No. Okay. Well, we'll look into that. Yeah, the doctor had a good morning, and if you're on the receiving end of somebody that's interacting with you like that, this is the representative of the surgical team. To normal response, you're already anxious. Mm-hmm. And you're already worried about what's going on. And now you're picking up all these cues that, like, something's really wrong. And all of a sudden now your stress levels are going up. Your blood pressure is going up. You're going to probably be less responsive to medication. When you get cut, you might bleed more. It's just your outcomes are going to be arguably less favorable. And all this because, you know, this surgeon wasn't trained to understand, like, his role was not only to be the technical expert, but was to bring the best out of his whole team, right? And so I did a little just kind of personal experiment afterwards. I just would ask people, like, okay, so if you had to go in for a surgery and you had the best surgeon on the planet, technically best surgeon on the planet, but questionable people skills, or somebody who is really good, but just exceptional with people, who would you pick? And almost everyone picks the best surgeon on the planet because they think what they want is like somebody that's technically competent. And then, you know, I tell them, a $2 infection because the OR tech is frazzled and hasn't properly sterilized the equipment, or something happens and they don't feel comfortable communicating it, can ruin a $10 million surgery if there was a $10 million surgery.
Yeah, I agree. It's very, very important. We're a little past that halfway point, so we're going to take a quick break and we will be back with Dr. Shocko in just a moment. Thank you for listening. This is Heartstock. Thank you for listening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy, your host. This evening, our guest is Dr. Andrew Shocko, and we're talking about redesigning healthcare or using very specific scientific approaches to help improve healthcare for the future. And we were just talking about leadership. And I know, Dr. Shocko, you wanted to say a few more things about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting looking at, like, if I look at my clinical practice and what makes me effective, I use my leadership skills much more often clinically, whether it be to help align the patient with whatever vision we're creating for where they want to go and what kind of life they want to create, or being able to inspire the other clinicians that are involved in the case to kind of rally around a central idea of what health looks like for that patient. So it's such a fundamental skill that I think it's really important. And unfortunately, systemically, we're still operating under this old paradigm of the physician is the scientist. And that ends up being how we screen for clinicians, how we train them. But we fail. We're failing in that process to recognize how much more of the art is present in the leadership aspect and why we need to really cultivate that.
Yeah, I think we all have encountered examples of really smart people that kind of flounder in the chairside or bedside manner department. And design thinking, you know, there's these two different perspectives that seem important in order to solve some of the big problems that we have. And one is the patient mm-hmm. perspective, and one is the physician's perspective. Can we approach both of these perspectives with design thinking? And what does that definitely look like?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So first, let me explain a little bit of what design thinking is. And simply, it really is just a process for creative problem solving. So take all the mystery away. It really is about creative problem solving. And, you know, like recognizing our time constraints, I'm going to get into a quick story because I think it really effectively demonstrates that. So in 2007, there were these five graduate students at Stanford, and they came together for a class in design for sustainability. And these weren't designers, and they weren't healthcare professionals. They came from electrical engineering and computer science and the business school, and all came together to work on a project. And the project they were given was premature infant mortality. So every year, by some estimates, about 20 million infants are born prematurely around the world. And 1 million of those die within the first 24 hours, and 4 million within the first 4 weeks. And these are obviously, you know, estimates. And the biggest cause of that is hypothermia. So infants that are born that premature don't have the resources or even the mass to kind of just keep their body at the right temperature. And when they are able to do it, it's taking away so much energy from the development of organs that would have been normally been developing in utero. And so then they end up with these like lifetime clinical problems as well. So they were looking at this problem, and in our first world, quote unquote, solution, we use these incubators, but incubators run around $20,000. And most of these premature infant mortality problems exist in the third world. So they very naturally assumed that the problem is these were too expensive and started working on making a cheaper incubator. Well, while they were doing this, one of the team members ended up flying to Nepal. And while he was there, he was going through a hospital and he saw all these empty incubators lying around. And he was a little bit befuddled, for lack of a better word, around this disconnect. And so he approached the doctor, and one of the doctors, and said, explain this if you can. And said, Doug, yeah, well, the babies aren't dying here in the hospital. They're dying in the villages. And that's when it hit him. And it was like, there's something wrong with how they were approaching the problem. So they went back to the drawing board, and they decided what they needed to do was design for the young mother who was going to be there, obviously, at the scene, as opposed to designing for the clinician, because incubators were designed for clinicians and they were designed for clinicians that had access to stable electricity. Well, the young mother in the village with the baby that was at risk didn't either had a clinician available necessarily or stable electricity. So what could they do in that setting? And on top of that, they didn't typically trust Western medicine. So if you were to say, give them 2 spoons of this, give the baby 2 spoons of this, they might be like, well, that might be a little strong for our baby. How about 1 spoon? Or keep the baby at 37 degrees. Oh, that's a little warm. How about 30 degrees? So there had to be built into this like a very easy solution. So what they came up with was instead this basically a papoose or a sleeping bag, if you will, for the baby where they get bundled up. And in the back, there is a sleeve or a space to insert this paraffin wax sleeve. And now the great thing about this paraffin wax sleeve is it goes through phase change at the exact right temperature. And so you can throw this thing in a pot of boiling water and it will heat up and in the process absorb enough energy so that as it's kind of going back through the phase change, it can maintain the right temperature for up to 5 hours.
Very practical.
All to do. Yeah. Totally. And easily implementable and costs 1/200th the price of
an incubator.
The incubator. Right. And so.
So smart. Yeah. We unfortunately run out of time already. Oh. Time goes by so quickly.
It does.
But that's a very poignant example. Can you let people know how they might contact you and reach out?
Definitely. So the easiest way is going through my website. It's www.chacomd.com. So that's spelled out chacomd.com. Or you can email me at info@chacomd.com. That'd be probably the easiest way.
Yes. And like so many of our other guests, I feel like we need to have you back because there are a lot of other
so many areas
yet to explore and kind of delve into this further, because healthcare, number one, it's very important, and number two, I think we do have the tools now to solve a lot of these problems. This has been Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy. Thank you, Doctor, for being on the show. It's fun.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we need a 48-hour radio show.
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week. Peace.
And on the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.
That sign was made.